Five, four, three, two, one.
What's the situation, Captain?
This is Situation Fluxus, a weekly one-hour program focused on jazz and improvised music, news, radio, conversations, and more. Thank you for tuning in to Situation Fluxus on WGXC 90.7 FM, listener-supported radio for open ears in upstate New York. I'm your host, Cheryl Kay. Let us dig into the headlines. The Blue Note Jazz Festival continues through June. Tonight, June 9th, through Sunday, June 12th, guitarist Al DiMeola, keyboardist Herbie Hancock, and vocalist Yumi Ito. For more information, BlueNoteJazzFestival.com. Tickets are now on sale for the Creative Music Studio, the Celebration event at the Bearsville Theater in Woodstock, New York, on August 6th. For more information, BearsvilleTheater.com. Tonight through Saturday, June 11th, guitarist George Freeman will be at the Jazz Showcase with organist Joey DeFrancesco, drummer Lewis Nash, and bassist Ivan Taylor. For more information, JazzShowcase.com. Pianist and composer Armin Demelian performs at Gateways Inn in Lenox, Massachusetts, tomorrow night, Friday, June 10th, with vocalist Natalia Burnell at 6 p.m. For more information, gatewaysin.com. At the Stone in New York City, tonight and tomorrow night, June 9th and 10th, Glass Triangle with special guests on both nights. For more information, thestonenyc.com. This Friday and Saturday night, June 10th and 11th, at the Jazz Forum in Tarrytown, New York, guitarist John Pizzarelli and his trio for two sets. And on Sunday, June 12th, for two sets, pianist Amina Figueroa and her quintet. For more information, jazzformarts.org. Saxophonist Javon Jackson and poet and activist Nikki Giovanni's album release concert at the Brooklyn Academy of Music in Brooklyn, New York, is this Saturday, June 11th. They're celebrating their new release, The Gospel According to Nikki Giovanni, on Solid Jackson Records. For more information, BAM.org. Jazz Sundays at the Falcon in Marlborough, New York. This Sunday, June 12th at 7 p.m., pianist Jean-Michel Pilk, bassist Francois Mouton, and drummer Ari Honig. For more information, liveatthefalcon.com. And on June 13th for two sets, trombonist Ed Neumeister and his quartet at Smalls in New York City. For more information, smallslive.com. And now for new releases. Coming out tomorrow, Friday, June 10th, vocalist Shiri Zorn and guitarist George Muscatello's self-release Into Another Land. Vocalist Don Paul and Rivers Answer Moon's Love Over War on Irresistible Revolutionary. And drummer, percussionist, and composer George Lernis's Between Two Worlds on Dunya. Other new releases out now, harmonica player Hendrik Merkens and the WDR Big Band's Samba Jazz Odyssey on Zoho, pianist Florian Hoffner's Desert Bloom on Alma, saxophonist Travis LaPlante's Wild Tapestry on Out of Your Head, and keyboardist Martin Bejarano's self-release Hashtag Cuban American. All news items have been gathered from various media sources. For the latest updates, contact the source, venue, or business. Remember, I'm just the messenger. My guests are Nico Van Echten and Pharaoh, sound and lighting technicians, both working with this year's Bronx River Arts Center's Bronx River Sounds Performing Arts Healing, Harmony, and Rejuvenation Festival in Bronx, New York, taking place on the three remaining Saturdays in June, the 11th, 18th, and 25th, and the Juneteenth Legacy Project on Friday, June 17th. The festival offers a month of jazz and pop performances. So, gentlemen, I want to thank you both for joining me here on Situation Fluxus. What is some of the upfront information that you look for in a tech writer? But first, will you please explain what a tech writer is? Pharaoh.
Right. We are looking for the specifics with regards to their instrumentation, the number of players, whether they want any form of compression, any specifics on the equalization, reverb, digital delay, you know, because if it's a one-off, I mean, when you're traveling with a group, you know all of those nuances. But when it's just a one-shot deal, you don't. And in many instances, well, in every instance, it's something different, you know, because one group may have a requirement for 20 microphones. Mm-hmm. And another group may only have a requirement for 5. You know what I mean? So it depends. And then it's the venue. Right. All of those environmental pieces play a role. So more specifically to your point, to your question, whatever it is that they specifically say that they need, those are the things that is part of what it is that you asked.
Okay. And Nico, what do you look for?
Well, I think, you know, when I'm dealing with any client, my goal is to really, we've come together in some way. They found out that I do the services that I do, and the services I do include audio and video and lighting, some combination of those things. Sometimes it's just one thing. On Saturday, I did a lighting job for a client that you know, Bronx River Arts Center. And then I got a phone call that morning that I needed to do sound for a hotel club. And the hotel club was very different from the earlier event because A, it was sound, B, it's late at night, and C, it's a client that wants a very different type of service. So when you look at, and in these particular instances, I didn't have a physical tech writer, but because these jobs sometimes come so quickly. But if there's more time, like I'm doing a wedding coming up in July, we have several weeks, actually we've had a couple of months. And in that case, it really comes down to the situation of what's happening. If you're dealing with a band, obviously the band has a style of music. If they have a vocalist, you have to find out what kind of vocalist they are. Is it a person with a tenor voice or an alto voice? Because you can use different microphones based on that. And it's important then obviously to have a collection of equipment that accommodates your client. So all of that being said, it really comes down to finding out what the client wants. Sometimes clients don't know what they need, and that's why they hire you. And that's that's an important component of things. So they think they know what they want, but they don't have the nomenclature. They're technically not proficient. And that's where you have to take the reins and educate them. Mm-hmm. Even if something is, we're talking on Zoom right now. Zoom has been incredible, as you know, as everybody knows. It's become a verb. And when things become a verb, they kind of become ubiquitous. But within that ubiquity, there are some technical jargon, there's some processes that specialists can come in and help out. And that's where Pharaoh and myself and others in our industry are able to be really helpful.
What types of groups give you the most consternation over their tech writers? And I'll start with this one, because I worked in a fine arts center. Okay. And the producer brought in a ballet on ice.
Oh, wow.
And it was one of those WTF moments.
Yeah.
And the, Yeah, and it was. It took the folks in the back, the tech people, weeks for them to try to figure out how to do this. But somehow they created an ice rink on the stage.
Okay.
So, Pharaoh, for you, what's been one of those, you know, moments where it's like, what is this?
Gosh. See, I know both sides of it because I'm a musician, producer, writer, travel, tours, all that stuff, right? So I've been on the front side of it, right? So I also know the back side. And I could sit here and tell you stories for days. At the end of the day, the bottom line is the relationship that you have with a particular artist and or group, and the ability to be able to address their needs, because that's in any industry. You need to have the professionalism to address the needs to get the job done. I mean, that's really what it is. And again, based upon the venue and the, you know, all of the things that are associated, it plays a major role. So if you have a situation where the venue is hard floored, you're gonna have, it's hard floored, and let's say 5,000 people, right? You're gonna have a situation where you're gonna have natural reverb and hard walls. You're gonna have natural reverb, right? Back, you're gonna have bounce back, your front of house, back, all of that is going to play a major role in how you're going to address what it is that this particular artist and or group needs to have happen to make sure that their performance is a good and successful one. Again, if you're traveling on tour with them, you know what their needs are. And even still, you know, from one venue to the next, it's going to change because of the environmental audio associated things that are involved, because no two places are going to sound the same.
Yep.
You know that. I mean,
I know that.
It's just not going to, and without a decent or proper sound check, oh my goodness. Woo. That's a nightmare. Because the group can sound great on stage and sound like crap to the people. You know, so the technician's responsibility, the tech people's responsibility to make sure that everybody gets a good quality of the sound and of the performance in the way in which the artist wants it to be presented.
Yeah. The conflict in my situation was between what the producer wanted and what the tech crew could do. And there had to be much education for this producer to understand what it took to put on a show, whether it was a ballet on ice or an opera or a string ensemble.
Yeah, that's all of that. It's totally different. Each one of those categorically, you know, you got, yeah, that's a mixed bag of nuts.
Yeah. Nico.
I think that bridging the gap between fantasy and reality with tech writers sometimes probably, like, you know, I mean, that I'm sure that was very challenging, but I think, you know, if you're privileged enough to have a career and a job, and you have, you know, you can overcome difficult challenges. Usually difficult people are more difficult, and that's, I think we'll get into that for me, that's a real linchpin to having a successful business, to being successful as a human being, really, is to not have I was just thinking of it on my way back home. There are these little armadillo bugs, and you touch them and they curl up. And in life, our impulse is to curl up often. And I think with training, you cannot curl up. And when you have a situation where there's a difficult rider, like what you're talking about, and I have a good example, you know, I think that then you can overcome it. But when you're dealing with difficult people, it's important to kind of meet them where they're at, because they could be upset or not easy to deal with for a variety of reasons, and you're not necessarily their psychiatrist. But what you can do is you have a positive attitude, privilege the positive, and you end up with a much better outcome. So, I mean, I would have to think, I think that people who do not communicate, clients that don't communicate clearly about what they want can be difficult. And I had an experience like this. It was a little bit traumatic. I was doing audiovisual production for billionaires. I don't really know. Nothing against billionaires. It's not like one person's more important than the other, but there was some importance to the moment, and they were doing a presentation about Hudson Yards. And so I was brought in as a subcontractor through really my mentor, Don Jacobs, who runs a company. And he trained me as a young man to do sound, and I'm really indebted to him. But what happened was basically I got thrown into the fire. Somebody had a PowerPoint presentation. I was responsible for bringing in the televisions and running that. But that was what I was hired to do, to run the technical component of making pictures on the screen, bringing in the video mixer and making that happen. But the client had a PowerPoint presentation. They didn't know exactly how to use PowerPoint, even though they've made the presentation. I didn't really get into the specifics of it, but my job was it wasn't to do the PowerPoint, but when they couldn't do it, I explained to them, this is, you know, quietly, this isn't what I'm here to do right now, but I'll try to help you out. And then unfortunately, when it didn't go as planned, they got very upset at me. And that can be a difficult situation. There's not always a good solution in those situations either. And I think it's important to try to handle those things professionally, which I did. But I mean, that's one of those situations you don't want to be in. So it's important to communicate clearly on both ends. You know, clients need to communicate to the vendor, and the vendor needs to, you know, be. So I guess maybe the overarching idea of what we're talking about here is, if you've got multiple things that you're doing, you might want to have somebody assigned to doing that specific thing. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, and that makes things smooth.
Who or what led you into the profession that you are in now?
Go ahead, Nico.
Well, I could give you the 10-second or the 1 minute. I think I grew up in Washington, D.C., in a very in an atheist family, but I was around a lot of friends of mine who went to church, a lot of friends of mine who were African-American, Caribbean-American, that type of church. And so I found a great deal of joy going when I'd stay over at sleepovers when I was probably about 12, 13, and we'd be, you know, have breakfast in the morning, and they'd say, you want to go to church? And I said, yeah, that would be great. And, you know, it was fine with my family, they didn't care. And the experience was so positive. And I saw people performing and singing, and there was this reverie. I mean, I get goosebumps thinking about it to this day, because it was really just such a positive thing. But I might also add that my parents were musical. My father owned a jazz club, and he was a jazz pianist. So I had that in my bones, in my blood. But then to see this experience was very positive. And so when I was in high school, I was in bands, and I got to learn how to connect microphones to PA systems. And it was very sort of I can't emphasize how important, if you like doing something, it really makes it a very joyful experience if you could commodify that. So in college, I was in a gospel group singing, and they, at some point, and we would tour around, and it was so much fun, and I really enjoyed the experience. I got to meet some really lifelong friends. But in that process, they needed a sound person, because we would go into churches and things weren't sounding good. And I would end up doing that anyway, sort of, but we needed our own sound system. And a friend of mine who was storing his sound system at my, where I lived in college, said, well, you know, if you ever need to use it, just use it, and that's fine. So what ended up happening is I ended up getting hired, not for much money, and of course, you know, but they wanted to pay me because it was a lot of extra work. Mm-hmm. So I had my first job was really being a sound person for a gospel band, a gospel choir. And I learned how to EQ, you know, better. It was that trial by fire where you get thrown in and you're just, you know, you're really figuring it out. Maybe I should say trial by water if it's but I thought of that. But yeah, so So that, and then other people found out that I did that, and I started to do sound for bands and events at college. And in college, I had a business informally. It wasn't incorporated or anything, but and then I started buying equipment, and I had this place I lived off campus, and I was in a band at that point. And then, so it was all very organic, and that's incredible. If you can find something you love to do and it just sort of comes together. It doesn't always come together that way. And I've worked as a copywriter. I mean, I went to school for journalism, so I worked as a copywriter. Very, very difficult when I moved to New York to get a job like that. But ultimately, I've just been able to gravitate towards doing what I love, which is being involved with musicians and jazz and blues and electronic music and stuff like that. It's so that's kind of how I got into it.
Cool.
Oh, see, that's personal. It goes down to family. My cousin, who basically was, he was my mentor, from very, very, again, front part of it is that I'm a musician, right? And I evolved over the years, right? With regards to recording and all the things that are associated with putting on a show, putting on a performance, what's involved, all of those kind of things. So my first exposure was through my cousin who played guitar, and I was just so fascinated, right? So that jumped me straight in.
So the tech stuff, the sound stuff, you learned basically on the job as you were running?
Well, yes, on the job and just continual education. He's not here now, but we launched the first series with Gail at BRAC, the Bronx River Arts Center, yesterday. And I have a gentleman that works with me. His name is George Watkins. This guy's a genius. It's like talking, when you talk to him, it's like talking to Spock. He designed. I'm sure you're familiar with the Cotton Club in New York, right?
Yep.
He designed the sound system. He completely designed it himself, put it together and all of that kind of stuff. And my technical knowledge really sort of kind of got sparked through him. Because, you asked this guy a question. I'll never forget. I remember we were playing with a group, and one of the singers asked him, what's the difference between an SM57 and an SM58.
And these are types of microphones.
And George started talking, and the guy looked at him like Bambi in the headlights. And he started walking backwards away from him because he had no clue. Because he went there. I mean, he went there in terms of frequency, sound, and yeah. So being in that type of company, in addition to so many, many, many other people, we were close, we were friends and so forth like that. The being in that type of company, that gave me a significant, reasonable amount of, one-on-one education, in addition to all the other things that I have studied myself.
Pharaoh.
Yes.
In your career, what are the technical advances that are making what you do backstage easier?
Okay, so once upon a time, you used to have point people to check for sound. Now you can use an iPad. And you can walk around with the iPad and make adjustments on your iPad or your phone. Because you can be tapped directly into the mixer. I mean,
That's amazing.
That's amazing. A lot of churches, they have the sound technician can sit there with his family or her family, right? While church is going on, and they can just be making adjustments. They can bring the pastor up, bring the pastor down, bring the chorus up, right there. So if that answers your question, that is the answer.
It's just very front and center, like this technology that we're in. Although yesterday we tried to do it on a phone and I couldn't, but the advantages also can be the disadvantages. And that's that you become very reliant on technology, but technology is enabling a democratization of you know, it's equalizing the playing field. A kid in Zimbabwe can share music as easily as I can. And not that, you know, I mean, people all over the world, there's a sort of lack of friction that technology enables, but backstage specifically, you know, apps are enabling people to do everything from tuning their guitars to recording sets to putting their playlists on. I have a mixer that I use that if somebody has a has an iPhone, they can control their iPhone mix. You know, we have monitors on stage. They can control the volume themselves. That's a very positive experience because I'm enabling the musician. Historically, it's the sound mixer who is deciding that, you know, he or she is deciding how loud it should be for a particular musician. And the musician, you've seen it on stage, like up or down. And that, of course, is fine. But if a musician, if you enable the musicians to be able to have control over their own listening environment, A, it protects their ears, which is great. And B, it allows the mixer to focus on other things like the overall sound quality. The other thing that I often do is I'm able to walk around with an iPad now and I can listen to the mix as if I were an audience member, not just in one position, which is great. Because if everybody thinks that the mix sounds good from the center, that's one thing. But historically, sound mixers would have to go, you know, you walk away from the mixer and you come back, and you walk away from the mixer and come back. You know, it's just very, very, you know, as I said, it becomes much more frictionless. And,
yeah.
And because I do lighting, it's the same thing is true for lighting as well. I mean, lighting is not you don't have to walk around the space really the same way, but you're not tethered. You're basically not tethered anymore. I mean, I'm laughing though, because yesterday I was in a small town, we were trying to do Zoom, and it's at those moments where you realize it's not like, my Spotify playlist isn't coming through, or with Spotify or Pandora, I have an offline mode. You don't have an offline mode for real-time stuff. So there you do become more dependent on, as you become more dependent on technology, you then become a little bit, you know, indentured to its deficiencies, you know?
Pharaoh, what groups in the festival are you looking forward to working with?
So I'm working with five different situations. And Ron Granger and Michael is one of them. I'm going to be working with Annette Aguilera, who's a percussionist. You know, I see her like, you know, she's like another kind of like Sheila E. person, right? I hope that she doesn't get offended, but I mean, she's incredible. She's incredible, right? And so I'll be working with her next week, right? And then finally, on Friday the 17th, I'll be working with Juneteenth, right? They are a group that performs classical music, right? Their layout is pianist, vocalist, cellist, a violist, and two violins. Very interesting. And the music that they play, their focal point is on Black composers, Black classical composers and music that was created that you normally would not hear. They also do popular music as well, but that's where they're at from all that I've been. I haven't met them yet, but I will. but I've seen them, and to go back to a better point, I like to see what the musician or musicians do before I even, you know, get an opportunity to work with them. And that's on every level. I mean, that's in a performance, if I'm going to do a performance or do a recording session with them. I like to, you know, because I do a lot of different things.
So do you view them through TikTok or YouTube?
Yeah, whatever. Yeah. Whatever they have. Whatever they have. Yeah.
All right. And Nico, who are you looking forward to working with?
Well, I'm going to be very honest with you. I found out about the job with Gail 6 days ago. So I do not know. The only groups I knew about were the ones that we played with. I didn't have a chance to listen to them. I don't know who's playing, and I feel badly about that. But I'm excited to find out who's playing. I'll tell you that the two groups that played, if any of them, if the groups that are going to be playing in the future are anything like what I heard this past weekend, everybody's in for a treat, because there were two totally different types of jazz. You know, the first group was a sort of a classic jazz mixed with some contemporary R&B takes on jazz, Aretha mm-hmm. Franklin. There was a Marvin Gaye standard, and that was lovely. It was a quintet, and there was a guest singer whose name I don't remember. I think she originally was working with Patti LaBelle, and she was on Sal Soul when she was 17. So, you know, you have these very high quality musicians. And jazz is such a beautiful conversation, and it's such an important part of American culture that when you have the opportunity to watch it live, and especially for people who maybe didn't grow up with it, I think if you can just expose people to this conversation, this musical conversation, it really opened. I mean, my son, who's 4, was there, and he was mesmerized because we were listening to Kind of Blue going down when I was on the way down to the show, and I'm really trying to get that sound in his head as something as a young person. So when he's older, it's like a lingua franca. He just knows what it is. And it's beautiful because, I mean, when you hear the first strains of Kind of Blue, it's just, for me, again, it's sort of, I get goosebumps. It's just, there's nothing like it. It is classical music, you know.
For more information, bronxriverart.org. You're listening to Situation Fluxus on WGXC 90.7 FM, listener supported radio for open ears. I'm your host, Cheryl Kay. Please send your comments, quips, and anecdotes, as well as feedback to thejazzdisturbance@gmail.com. info@wgxc.org, feedback@wgxc.org, or leave a 3-minute message at area code 518-291-WGXC. Our website is wgxc.org.
Alrighty, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Dizzy's Club at Jazz Lincoln Center. Thank you for joining us here this evening. We're about to hear some great music by some wonderful and extraordinary artists. So please help me welcome to the stage the Sean Mason Trio.
We have Malcolm Charles on drums, everybody. Malcolm Charles. Mr. Butler Knowles on the bass. We're excited to be here. Thank you guys so much for coming out.
My interview is with pianist, composer, orchestrator, and music director Sean Mason. The Jazz at Lincoln Center emerging artist and his quintet will offer guided instruction to Columbia County New York School jazz ensembles and give a public performance on Friday, June 10th, as part of Pathways 2022, a program of PS 21, Performance Spaces for the 21st Century in Chatham, New York, that offers free, affordable, and accessible performances, classes, workshops, and encounters. So I want to thank you so much for joining me on Situation Fluxus.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be on.
Would you please give us a rundown of your day and night at PS 21 this Friday, June 10th?
Yeah, I mean, I like to quote unquote teach and help guide kids in multiple different ways. The first is from a place of inspiration. And I keep that center at all times, just because I remember when I was a kid. I think it's important to inspire first before you get into the specifics of what music is supposed to sound like. People have to love the music. And I like to keep that first of showing people the joy that can come with music, the spiritual effect that can come with music, and letting kids and also audiences feel that first in their soul. And then once that is achieved the best I can, then we go into the specifics of jazz music and improvisation and technique and different ways to do things. But none of that matters until people have to actually love the music and want to do the music and feel a spiritual connection with you and with the music. So I keep those principles first every time I talk to students and also perform.
I've always liked young people. When I taught, I considered them mine for the time I had them in the classroom and on the bandstand. Has educating and mentoring young people been your preference or vocation, or have opportunities offered themselves to you and you've grown into the role of educator and mentor?
I never set out to be an educator, like a music educator. That was never one of my main goals. So the latter is what applies most to me. I had to learn how to take what I know and what I learned, because I was primarily self-taught, which is why I never sought out to be an educator, because I didn't come from a strong musical education background myself. I had one piano teacher for a short period of time after I started kind of teaching myself. And then throughout the rest of high school, I taught myself, but I did have mentors along the way. So I do love the idea of mentoring, but I didn't have like formal education until I went to college. And so I had to learn, which I think is better for me as I teach and do more teaching now, is that I come from sort of an unconventional way. I don't know the correct way to teach music because I didn't learn that way. So I just kind of create my own methods of teaching music that worked for me and that I think are most helpful. And I just share that and pass that down. So it definitely was the latter.
Okay. You're a Jazz at Lincoln Center emerging artist. What are you doing and creating through this program?
Yeah, so we're going out. Today is Monday morning. I'm leaving in about an hour and change, and we're hitting the road to go all over the Northeast with two different missions in mind. One is to perform, like a traditional performance, and the other is education. With those two in mind, each location that we go to, there's gonna be an education component and there's also gonna be a performance component. Those two things are slightly different in my mind. They're just different approaches. They have a lot of similarities, which I kind of described in the first question of the spiritual thing. Mm-hmm. And so that's pretty much what we're doing. And I'm learning a lot about how to craft the right masterclass. And all of it is similar to jazz, because when you get to the location, everything that you plan can change based on the students, based on the energy in the room, based on how people are receiving the information. So I have to be very flexible in how I decide to teach the information. But those two cores are center of this emerging artist tour that's coming up.
Is one of the people that you work with, trumpeter and Jazz at Lincoln Center artistic director, Wynton Marsalis?
Yeah, Wynton is a very close mentor of mine. I met Wynton through his brother, Branford Marsalis. I was born and raised in Charlotte, North Carolina, and I met Branford in Durham. He lives in Durham, and I met him in North Carolina while I was attending the University of North Carolina at Greensboro. And he's been my main mentor primarily since then, and helped me out in a lot of different ways. And he introduced me to Wynton, and then I moved to New York and got involved with Jazz at Lincoln Center. So I work with Wynton a lot. We're doing some stuff on the road this summer with his septet. Mm-hmm. It's going to be really fun. But yeah, Wynton is a very close mentor of mine. And so is his brother. And also his other brother, Delfeo. And that whole family has been really, really good to me.
How about if we focus on the concert this Friday? and what the audience can expect to hear. You'll be playing with your quintet original music. Is this music for an upcoming release?
Yeah, I'm recording my debut album in July, and I'm really looking forward to that. This kind of tour and this performance on Friday is helping the band get tighter, to sound better, to really internalize the music so that when we actually record, we're not thinking too much. We already know the music like the back of our hands. So the audience can expect a wider range of original music. I write a lot of original music, and we may throw a couple of standards in there. I'm not anti-standards by any means, but primarily original music. And my original music is, it varies from style to style, but I would say it consistently maintains a spirit of church music, of the Black Southern church music that I grew up with. And it's not very obvious, but at times it is, but it always, to me, maintains that spirit of celebration and also of dance. I like to keep dance very centered. That doesn't necessarily mean that the rhythm and the groove is, you know, stoic or anti-dynamic, but I always like to keep this center, this thing of dance and this thing of fun. So that's kind of the emotion that you can expect to hear, is that we just like to have fun on stage. We just smile the whole time. To me, music is fun. And The pandemic really nailed that in the coffin for me, that music is fun. Music is the light of this world. It is necessary. That was a high question for a lot of artists during the pandemic, is what is necessary? Because most people were able to take their work remotely, my parents included. A lot of my friends that I went to school with were able to just work from home and everything be okay. And the language that the world news would use of necessary work, like what work is necessary through this time. And the arts were not necessary in the language that they used. And so I hold the opinion that art is quite necessary for the fulfillment of the human race and for the advancement of the human race. That art and culture drive society and drive the way we think about work and the way we think about the economy and everything that follows. So after the experience of the pandemic, I really am grateful every time I'm able to sit at the piano and play music. I approach it with the spirit of gratitude. So that's why we have so much fun and we don't worry about making mistakes. And it's all just love and joy on stage.
Well, Sean, I'd like to give you the last word of this interview. Is there a question that I haven't asked you? Is there something you'd like to tell us about yourself or some upcoming projects? You already talked about a new release coming out in July.
Yeah. Other than the release, I just want to, again, express gratitude for having me on Friday. And I don't take any of that for granted. I don't take performing for people for granted. So I just want to really get the point across that I'm grateful for all that are willing to listen and all that are willing to receive the information that I teach and share through the education component. So I'm grateful for you, Cheryl, and grateful for everybody for allowing me to be there on Friday. And I really look forward to being there.
For more information about Sean Mason, seanmasonofficial.com, and for more information about PS21, PS21, that's the number 21, PS21Chatham.org. And now for some music.
Into another land, free. Finally from all the pain inside me. Waken to the sound of rain. on streaming. Here I am, the same old place. Fever dream, my body's tossing. And in a flash, I see her face. Waving hand, I must be crossing.
Can't you behave? Can't you be good? And do just as you should. Won't you turn that new leaf over so your baby can be your slave? Oh, why can't you behave? There's a farm I know near my old hometown. Where we two can go and try settling down. There I'll care for you forever, 'cause you're all in the world I crave. But baby, why can't you behave? I said I'll care for you forever, 'cause you're all in the world I crave. But why can't you behave? Baby, I'm all confused.
Born on June 9, 1891, composer and songwriter Cole Albert Porter, known for his witty lyricism that were hits on Broadway and in films, songs that became standards. We just heard from vocalist and actor Frank Sinatra in 1948 with Why Can't You Behave from the 2003 Columbia Legacy compilation Sinatra Sings Cole Porter. The song is from Porter's musical Kiss Me, Kate. And vocalist Sherry Zorn, who gigs around Saratoga, New York, and guitarist George Muscatello, with the composition Witch Touch from their self-release Into Another Land that became available on Friday, June 10th. They're joined by percussionist Mauricio Mottarelli. Thank you for tuning in to Situation Fluxus on WGXC 90.7 FM, listener-supported radio for open ears. I've been your host, Cheryl Kay. Tune in next Thursday at 10 a.m. for another show. I also host The Jazz Disturbance on the 1st, 2nd, 3rd, and 5th Sunday of each month from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. To contact us about Situation Fluxus, thejazzdisturbance@gmail.com or info@wgxc.org. We appreciate your feedback. Feedback@wgxc.org or leave a 3-minute message at area code 518-291-WGXC. Thank you.